Professor Rubenstein's immigration law class, room 243, on November 26,
2008. Yeah, I know it's like for sure you, me, and Nate didn't have it. It's not in that class. So it'll probably be the three of us. Yeah, it's like the first one to our mind. I imagine though that it'll be noticed that we're not there. Right, among both our classmates and our professors. And then she's like, oh my god, what happened? And she wouldn't, right? And then you're like, oh yeah, nothing happened. But when you seem like him, you now know who it is.
Yeah, I'm not excited to be here.
Thank you.
Cool.
There you go. All right, we're almost there. Thank you for your patience. I know you don't care, but I've been very good about starting on time, and it's like, you know, get almost to the end of the semester, and then it was partly my fault and partly the setup's fault. All right, let's start, though. We went through a matter of AME rather quickly at the end of last class, but I do want to go over again and in some more detail because it's an important development in social group cases. And we went over the procedural history, which I won't repeat here. But I love that when they're at the border, they don't have a fear, and then all of a sudden they do when they're in removal proceedings. That's not uncommon, by the way. And it also doesn't bar them from applying for asylum. They are entitled to change their mind, but then it just goes to an issue of credibility, right? Okay, let's, before we get there, now, what does the BIA hold? We said that the BIA imposed some additional requirements to the social group. You always need visibility. And I want to say something about social visibility and particularity. Cognizability, it's probably not a separate requirement. It's probably subsumed within the social visibility. But maybe there's something about this cognizability principle, not only that it's that the group is socially visible, but it's one that we would recognize legally in our society as a social group. Like, if you had a group of people claim, like a group of criminals claiming we're a particular social group because we're gang members or we're criminals, maybe even though it's a socially visible group, maybe it's not legally cognizable. It's not something that this case really talks about in all that much, it really talks about at all, but it's something to keep an eye on maybe in future cases. Now, with respect to social visibility, it's not exactly clear what that means. It says social visibility, and that could just be considered in a vacuum, but then it later says that social visibility as a group at risk for the type of persecution feared. So it's not just that it's a socially visible group, but maybe it's a group that's socially visible and understood by the community as a group that's at risk for the particular type of harm claimed. And I think it seems to be this latter definition that the court's imposing, even though it uses the social visibility as a shorthand. Okay, so it's important. It's not just that it's socially visible, but also that the society as a whole would recognize the group as one that's particularly prone to the type of harm being alleged. Now, what is the BIA, in this case, AME, hold with respect to the social visibility requirement? What does the BIA say with respect to that? Yes?
There's two qualifiers prior to actually conducting an analysis. So first off, we look at, one, the context of the country of concern to Guatemala, and two, the persecution here.
Right, that's what we just covered. And so factually, you know, applying the law to the facts, what does the court say?
So they look at the country profile and they say, okay, there's some reason for concern, but I don't think it rises to that level of the risk level for affluent Guatemalan country. academic work. So they do, I think they went through, I didn't read this for like 2 weeks, but they go through something that said, you know, there's risk of robberies and kidnappings and all of these other crazy things, but it doesn't really rise to the threat level that they want to enunciate to narrow the category.
Well, no, actually, I think it's not really a question of it not rising to the level of persecution so much as what it says by looking at, you know, the State Department reports is that the society as a whole is being targeted for crime. And so even if affluent Guatemalans was a socially visible group, because you could look and say, okay, well, this person's driving a nicer car or has a car at all, the problem is that the rich or the wealthy are not being, are not at any greater risk, at least according to the State Department, than anybody else. And so that's this sort of tack-on requirement that the court adds, which really makes the difference in this case. It sort of highlights what it means to draw a distinction between simply being socially visible as opposed to being socially visible for the particular risk that's being claimed, the particular persecution that's being claimed. God bless you. And what is the BIA saying with respect to particularity? Someone else who read the case other than Michael. What does it say with respect to particularity? What is, this was the supplemental reading, the one that I emailed, that I posted 2 weeks ago. Yeah. Did anybody read it besides Michael?
2 weeks ago.
A while ago. Okay.
Look. It said that the group was to be quite on the line on particular numbers and that the kind of membership, so they shouldn't qualify. It's just that it's not now defined as.
Right, Kim's saying that it's not narrowly defined enough as a social group. That's part of it. The other part, since I do recognize that you probably read it a long time ago, and so just to keep things moving, is that it's too indeterminate. Like these concepts of wealth and being rich, well, who gets to say what rich is and wealth? It's all relative. And so it's the level of particularity just isn't there. Because how you define it, you could say that the group consists of wealthy Guatemalans, but where do you draw the line at wealthy Guatemalans? Who's to say what wealthy means? There's different conceptions. Now, there's something I just feel compelled to point out because it's so ridiculous. You know, the BIA notes that there, you know, that the attorney for the petitioner delegated 4 paragraphs discussing the nexus requirement, the on account of requirement. Remember that the persecution must be on account of the social group. And the BIA and the lawyer recognizes that wealth alone, you know, persecuting somebody on account of their wealth alone is not enough. So the lawyer tries to be creative and is trying to sort of link this maybe to a political opinion. So the lawyer cites to the State Department report, which is so far fine, so far so good. And the State Department report tells a story about a nun whose car was carjacked, and I think she was killed. And then there were some reports that perhaps the carjacking was motivated by political animus or because of, you know, her social group is someone who was helping out some people in need. And so he tries to draw the analogy between the nun whose car gets hijacked and his clients, and it's like so ridiculous. I mean, the court says, where's beef? You know, it's one thing to notice that you have to overcome a requirement. And it's one thing to look at the State Department report for support, and what he's trying to do is to say, well, there may have been a mixed motive here. It may not have only been because they were rich, but also because of their political opinion or because of some other reasons. Well, that's fine as a legal argument, but how does the nun story support that in any conceivable way? And so the BIA rejects that pretty easily.
But this is the type of lawyering work I'm asking you to try to avoid. I mean, I guess it was a good try. Let's change subject. Any questions about that?
Just briefly about sexual orientation as a social group. The BIA has recognized it as a particular social group. Now, whether someone has been persecuted on account of the social group or has a well-founded fear of persecution is a different issue. Okay, so just because you're in a social group, that's just one of the requirements for asylum eligibility. You have to prove more. And some of the issues is, well, it's going to turn on the degree of harm. What is exactly, is someone who falls into the social group fearing? Is it just discrimination? Is it harassment? Or does it rise to the level of persecution? You know, saying that homosexuals are part of the social group doesn't answer that very separate question. What if there's a crime? What if acts of homosexuality are a crime? Okay, so then the question is, well, is that prosecution or persecution? And we looked at, you know, trying to sort all that out. Is it being disproportionately applied? Is the law facially neutral, or is it specifically directed at homosexuals? Another issue, and I'm not trying to resolve these, because this is going to play itself out in cases. The other question is, if it's not the government that's doing it, but it's other non-state actors, is it a group that the government is unable or unwilling to control? Now, Kim, thanks to Kim who pointed this out, just a few days ago, the UNHCR passed guidelines. Remember, these guidelines are not binding, but these guidelines talk about some of these issues and how asylum claims should be considered in light of, you know, human rights considerations and what other countries are doing and so on and so forth. And I'll post these. I'll put these on Twin for those of you who might be interested in reading over it. But we're not going to spend time in class. Kim, do you have a question?
I have a question about prosecution. So even if a country has a law criminalizing homosexual activity, and that's prosecution in that country, would that person still be eligible for asylum here? Because aren't our laws isn't asylum based on the laws here? And because homosexuality is not a criminal act here,
no, well, that's a good question. The answer is, in general, it's too easy to say that we're going to base it on our own perceptions, because we do need to respect what other countries are determining to be prosecution versus persecution. Whether or not we think it crosses the line from prosecution to persecution is something that we may inject our own values into. But simply because we don't criminalize something and another country does, like, for example, wearing, you know, a headdress might be a crime in other countries. Not wearing it might be a crime in some Muslim countries, but it's not here. But it's still, we still might recognize that as a valid form of prosecution for those who don't comply. And so, you know, this is a sticky issue. You know, first of all, some of these laws are facially neutral. You know, some states in our country have laws criminalizing sodomy, you know, still. And it applies to men and women. The issue that becomes, well, is it being selectively applied to homosexuals? And when you start getting that selective enforcement, it starts looking a lot more like persecution than prosecution. But these are some of the issues, the difficult issues surrounding this, yeah.
This is like the disconnect between people like me who believe that all human rights are universal towards all people, because I see human rights when the abuses are committed, it's when these countries like Zimbabwe or whatever are saying, oh, in our country we don't have Western culture, this is a Western input. But they're just using that as an excuse to kill people and to murder them and run them out of the country for speaking their voices. Whereas other people, when in the strict cultural relativism.
Right.
Where they say that's okay, that's their culture, you know.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, you know, these are, I'm not getting outside of this context, I'm not an expert in this area of the law, but it goes to, you know, what are human rights? And what are internationally, you know, recognized human rights? People are claiming that certain things are human rights, but if the international community isn't recognizing it as one, how should it be treated for purposes?
The UN speaking is on it. speaking on it now. So
well, yes, and so and you should look to see if you're interested in this issue, what they're saying, as they talk about a lot of these issues.
This also goes, they just passed the Disappeared Persons Act as well, so this is just a similar issue to this thing. With regards to South America and regarding what the international community and what the conception of universal human rights
right.
with regards to governments that disappear people with quote marks, throwing them off planes, running them into the jungles and killing them and stuff. So, you know, I think when the UN speaks on an issue, I think it has a very important persuasive effect. At the very
yes, end. And this certainly will, and it remains to be seen. As I said, our country, you know, the BI has already recognized it as a social group. Other countries may not have. So we've already sort of gone a long way. Some of the more dicey questions about this prosecution versus persecution is something that is still remains to be seen how that's going to be handled by the courts. And certainly the guidelines are going to be persuasive and provide guidance. Daniel?
Sure. So aren't there like sovereignty issues with dictating whether or not under state law persecution, like objectively, who are we to say that your laws are, you know, they're not legitimate, or either way, and moreover, don't you have issues with, if you were to determine that certain laws, like, you know, the headdress, law would be considered persecution, wouldn't you then, you know, like, maybe something would come here that it's not exactly the through asylum, at least.
Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Part of the problem with our asylum law is drawing lines. Right. Some of the lines are easier to draw than others, and some of the trickier ones come, you know, where you know our society might regard something as violating human rights, but other societies may not. And who are, you know, your point? Who are we to say? And then the issue then turns to, well, is it internationally recognized? And that's why we have the UN, and that's why we have treaties, and that's why people sign, you know, countries sign onto these treaties to sort of create this international law so that we could guide us in our own domestic lawmaking. But it's part of the sticky situation. But your point of the sovereign nations is what makes it a difficult issue, because that's almost the starting point. You know, you start with the presumption that governments are allowed to regulate the conduct in their own societies, but then there comes a point when the international community is not going to sit by and watch. Any other questions? Let's talk about Faden or Fatten. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. This is the case where the woman applied for asylum, alleging she would be persecuted in Iran because of her membership in a social group. And we're going to talk in some more detail about what the social group was. Before we get there, it's sort of important to point this out. The court says in order to qualify for asylum based on a particular social group, the claimant must, number one, identify a particular social group. Okay, so this is nothing new. It adopts the Acosta's immutable characteristic test. And then it gives two more requirements. But what I want to emphasize is that these are not really modifying the social group requirement. These are more generally what somebody claiming to be in a social group would have to show in order to meet the other requirements for asylum eligibility, like the well-founded fear requirement, for example, and the on-account-of requirement. So it's not just to... You can't just identify a social group and say, I'm entitled to asylum, right? I mean, you have to prove that you're part of that social group. That makes sense. And second, the person will have to establish that they're being persecuted because of that membership. And it's going to be important to keep these requirements in mind as we parse through this case. It's a very difficult case. As you read it, you may get this sort of sense that they were backing their way into a conclusion. And we'll look at some of the logic of the decision, and you can tell me whether you agree or disagree with any of it. Now, the court identifies three possible social groups, which are spelled out in the notes following the case, although if you were just reading it on your own, you may have sort of passed over them. The first is that all women. Okay, so that's obviously That is a social group. You know, women can qualify as a social group. That's now established. Another possibility was women who find it offensive to be forced to wear the chador, which is the veil. Chador, am I saying it wrong? Chador? Chador, okay. But would do so. So this is women who find it offensive, but would wear the chador. And this is women who find it so offensive to wear the headgear, the headdress, that they would refuse to do so, but would refuse to do so despite the penalties. Okay, so these are the three different groups identified by the court based on her allegations. Did you have a hand up over here? No? Okay. Now, keeping these in mind, let's start with all women and go back to this. What does the court say? Why does the claim based on womanhood fail, according to the court? Matt?
The women's report says that all women don't find it objectionable in the first place, and even some that do don't find that it rises to the level of what they would constitute as persecution.
Right. You may be jumping ahead to the next group, but that's right. That's certainly right. Michael, did you want to add something?
This is like a legal requirement since 1983 for all women in Iran, so there's no differentiation for her. And later on she added some other things.
Well,
but
hold on, let me stop, because we're going to get to the other things later, but does anybody, I don't think we really nailed what the problem with the women is. Well, being a woman is an immutable characteristic, so that's not the problem, per se. Anna? Right. Right. So they look at this one, okay? Basically, they're saying, listen, and they don't really talk much about, because it's not in the record before the court, what the general conditions are in Iran, although we know that they're not all that pretty. But the court says that, yeah, women is a social group, but the problem is what she's complaining about, having to wear the chador, she's not being persecuted on account of her being a woman, per se. She's not being persecuted on account of her being a woman, because other women in the country are not being persecuted, either because they don't disagree with the policy, or just in generally, they're, you know, women as a whole are just, you're not being persecuted. So she has to sort of refine the social group, because being a woman alone is not going to be enough. Even though it satisfies the social group, it's not going to be enough to prove that she's being persecuted on account of being a woman alone. So she's going to have to refine her acclaimed social group. So, you know, it's not even clear whether she's making these arguments or the court's making them for her, you know, because the court gives excerpts from the brief. And that's my problem, is it seems like the court is just setting up, straw men just to knock them down. But anyway, the court says, arguably she has this other social group. It says women's not enough alone. Women who find it offensive to be forced to wear the chador, but would nevertheless do so. And what does the court say is to this one? And Matt, this is, I think, your point. But you want to repeat it so I can make sure.
The second group. Well, that it just doesn't rise to the level of persecution. They may find it inconvenient or not desirable, but it's not really something that affects them so detrimentally.
Right, exactly. So remember, persecution, drawing the line of where something becomes an annoyance to something becoming persecution, is a difficult line to draw. And here the court says that, you might find it offensive, but there's no evidence in the record that you wouldn't do so. So if you would do so, how is that persecution? What do you guys, first of all, what do you think about that? Do you think it is persecution, a law requiring women to wear the headdress? Is that persecution, or do you agree with the court that it's only persecution if it's like so vehemently against your ideologies that it would hurt so much to put this thing on? Yeah.
I
I don't think you can separate that from the possibility that if you don't wear it, you're going to be punished for not wearing it. So, I mean, I think that it's really like the same thing. If you don't do something, you'll be punished. So, obviously, you have to do it. So, I think that the punishment being so drastic makes it a form of persecution. Especially since it's
right.
Woman.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look to see why she would do so. And I think that's what Rose's point is. I mean, if the reason she's doing so is because she doesn't want to be stoned to death, then are we really going to hold that against her, as a reason for not qualifying for asylum? You know, if the punishment was less severe, like it was only extreme harassment, for example, instead of some of the more atrocious forms of punishment that could happen, then maybe there's some more credibility to this, yes.
And arguably, the reason why they require women to dress differently than men be that they consider women to be inferior or they consider women to be unclean, and that's a form of, targeting that. So, I mean, the fact that they have to wear something distinct for men on its own could arguably be a form of persecution. Because the reason that they have to do it is because they consider somehow inferior or problematic.
Right. But if the women agree with that, if there's women in the country who agree with that belief, because that's the way they've been raised, I mean, this particular woman doesn't, but if there are women who believe in that because that's part of their religious beliefs or cultural beliefs, then is it persecution as to them?
I think that's similar, I mean, like outside of the hypo, like when in the civil rights movement, when whites would point to like particular blacks that agree with the system and say, well, blacks don't have a problem with this. So I think it's like the same thing. You can't say that people who do have a problem with it shouldn't have a voice just because other people like have submitted to the system.
Right. Well, I think the court accounts for that. I mean, the court is not saying that it can never be persecution. What the court is saying is it can be, but it will depend on the person's own ideologies. Because for somebody, someone is forced to practice a religion, putting this one aside, it's not really persecution if they already believe in that religion, right? It only becomes persecution if you have some problem with it. And so here, the court looks at her evidence that she presented as saying, well, I would wear one, and sort of takes it out of context a little bit. I think for the first point you made, it's not really that she would wear one because she doesn't find it objectionable, but because she fears the result, the consequences if she doesn't. So it seems to be, it does seem to be a bit of a harsh standard that the court's applying here. Anybody else have any thoughts on it? So the third group was sort of the flip side of this coin. Women find it so offensive to be forced to wear it that they would refuse to do so despite the penalties. And what does the court say as to this one? Is this persecution? Patrick?
Yeah.
It's persecution, but so why does she lose?
Because she said that she wouldn't wear it.
Right. Right. Because she doesn't fit into this group. So you look back here to the last slide. And she fails under two. So she's sort of like in this catch-22 situation. The problem here for her is that, she could prove a social group, and she could prove persecution on account of a social group, but they don't match up. Because every time she comes up with a social group, she fails one of the other requirements, and every time she meets one of the other requirements, she fails to satisfy the social group. So she's sort of in this dilemma here, and it doesn't look like there's an easy way out for her. Jen?
If she decides that she refused to wear a veil, would the outcome be any different? Because I don't feel like
it's
worth
it. Do I think the outcome? What do you think?
I think it's more like their policy is we don't want people like this coming in and looking like gays, so we're going to make up for it.
Well, let's break down your question, because it's really one of, legal realism. Is the court just sort of backing into a decision or not? So I think the first part of the analysis is, if she had said that she wouldn't wear the headdress, would she have qualified under the test announced by the court?
I think the problem would still be in the well-founded fear of mean, she would definitely fit it in the third category, but she didn't pass the rest.
Well, what would, if she fit into the third category, what would she pass, do you think?
I think it's because it's the way it's taught, it's the other
Well, that's possible. Maybe the court would have had to then have decided that question. I don't know, though. I mean, I think that if you take the decision on face value, but the evidence was different, then I think she probably wins. But your point is more of a legal realist point, which is if she satisfied this, would the court have gone out and would the court have crafted a different test, a test that she couldn't satisfy? And I don't know. I don't know what the court may be. And it's a skeptical way of looking at things, but it's certainly possible.
Every woman in her arms would be like,
Yeah. I mean it's so interesting because it's, you know, the case, at least on a facial level, turned on her testimony, which could have very well been very different. Because it's not even an objective fact. All she would have to testify to is a subjective feeling. And the result would have been different. So what happens is, you know, this is great for this case, but then the next case, the story's different, obviously. Because whether the story's really different or whether the story is just claimed to be different, you never know. And then so the immigration judge is trying to grapple with, well, are they telling the truth or not? And it becomes a very difficult situation, you know? I mean, as the lawyer, how do you advise your client? It's tough. Right? Because you can't advise them to lie, but maybe you should tell them about this case, you know? Rosa?
I just have a question. So, I mean, I think the court is saying that it's not persecution because it's not women would agree.
I'm sorry, say what?
That it's not persecution because women are around would not all agree that they felt persecuted, I guess. But what if, at least for the Shador issue,
right.
But what if the Shador issue was just like a factor in a broader systematic discrimination against women, and they showed that was just one factor mm-hmm. in a broader discrimination?
Yeah, and I think that's what she may have been getting at, if you look at some of the excerpts from her brief, and the court doesn't really address it. Well, that's a different question then. But the issue then is, well, point to something in particular that you're claiming to be persecution. Because if you're saying it's just a generally bad place for women, that's not going to get you there. Because if it's just harassment or discrimination, that's not persecution for the same reason that this isn't. It just doesn't rise to the level. But if you say that, you know, women are being targeted and they're being raped, you know, because they're women, and it's just, that's a different story. That is, because that would be persecution. Yes.
Part of the brief, she talks about how she didn't want to practice a Muslim religion, but at the same time, she kind of did. Now, she didn't make an argument for being asylum on account of religion. But now the question is, if the state, I think the state forced her to practice religion, she tried to avoid doing so.
Right.
Would that be a ground for the asylum? She didn't go for
it. Well, the problem again, you still get to the same point. Which is that the shadow wearing, forcing someone to wear the shador is not persecution in itself.
Because she's on the fence with religion.
Right. But if she was vehemently opposed to it, then this would be in this social.
It wouldn't matter if that's a state sanctioned religion, if that doesn't matter, we don't take that into account, or you shouldn't be forced to change religion no matter what.
Yeah, no, Well, there's a little bit of a difference between forcing someone, you know, to practice religion and preventing somebody from practicing a religion. But just conceptually, there's a difference, and you could question whether or not they should be treated any, whether it's worse to force someone to practice religion or worse to prohibit someone from practicing their religion. But generally, you know, religion is a basis for asylum. So if you could prove that you're being persecuted, that this is intended to target people of opposite faiths and it's being applied that way, then you can qualify for asylum under it.
So a lawyer
they may have, except she might have failed for similar reasons, because again, forcing someone to wear the shadow, or whether you know, may not just be enough to constitute persecution, even if you don't believe, you know, even if you don't believe in the religion. But certainly it's an argument that could have and should have been made. Yes?
Like, adding to this argument, if in Iran they target religious groups more harshly than they target women, then wouldn't the Shador argument, like being a factor, would be more valid than it would be for the women argument?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So, no, those are all good questions. Let's move on. Defining well-founded fear. How is well-founded fear defined? How is well-founded fear defined? What's the standard? What do you have to show to establish a well-founded fear? Jen?
A clear probability of persecution.
That's not right, but it's a good try. What is that? A reasonable possibility. Now we're getting closer. Okay, now the first thing to point out is that there's no quantified definition of well-founded fear persecution. Okay, it's not like whether you have a 30, 40, 50, 60% chance. That'd be nice, I guess, in theory, if that was the case, it'd be a lot easier to know where the line was drawn. But so far, we don't have a quantified version of what well-founded fear means. In matter of Mogherati, 1987 case, the BI said that basically said the standard was whether a reasonable person in the applicant's position would fear persecution. So again, what's missing from here is any kind of, you know, preponderance of the evidence standard or beyond a reasonable doubt standard. It's just whether a reasonable person would fear persecution. So does that mean if you have a 10% chance of being persecuted, you satisfy it? Or do you need a 20% chance of persecution? A 1% chance of persecution? What I want to point out here, though, is the objective component of it. It's whether a reasonable person in the applicant's position, and that reasonable person test, which you probably encountered in other classes like torts, connotes an objective requirement. So it's not enough, although it is also required that the individual have a fear of persecution, subjectively. It also has to be an objective fear. And the objective requirement means that you have to come in not just with your testimony, like, I'm scared, but also some State Department reports or some other types of evidence proving that there's a basis for being scared, some objective basis. And the regulations, consistently with matter of Mogherati, say a reasonable possibility of suffering persecution. So here we have the word possibility. Again, is that 10%, 20%? Do you think if you were coming up with sort of trying to figure out in any given case, do you think maybe that we should just have a line, you know, 50% or 40% or do you think maybe that the amount of proof or the possibility should be commensurate with the type of harm you're fearing? So let me rephrase that. So if what you're fearing is torture or death, maybe you only have to show a 10% chance of it actually happening. But if what you're fearing is severe form of harassment, then maybe you have to show a 40% chance of it actually happening. What do you think of a test like that? Yeah?
How can we reduce this to a mathematical
formula? Can you? Should we?
Yeah.
I mean, no. You think we should or we shouldn't?
I say no.
You say no.
I think it's a decent idea. I'm not satisfied with it, but I just don't think we should apply rigid mathematical formulas to someone's life.
But putting aside the actual percentages you would attach, certainly you could have a system of you know, but just as a theory, as a sliding scale, do you think that? The problem with that, although I'm not saying I disagree or agree, I think it actually is certainly a good approach, is that you know, people who fear other types of harm are going to have a lower burden of proof, even though both of them would qualify as persecution. Is that what we want to do?
So, like, if somebody feared torture, they would have to show like a lower percentage of other person.
Right.
But then that wouldn't really take like the probability of that actually happening into account, because even though torture versus like let's say just regular persecution, it's a higher
garden variety of persecution.
Yeah. You know.
Couple of beatings.
Just maybe.
Right.
Whatever. Obviously, torture, you know, it's like a really, it's a big problem and people want to avoid it.
And it hurts more.
But if it's not likely to happen, then shouldn't we be protecting people from other risks that are more likely to happen? Because those people are still going to suffer, and their suffering is more likely to occur than somebody who has an option to be tortured.
Right, so that's the counter argument to why, to the sliding scale. I mean, maybe there's something to be said about the sliding scale, because if there's a chance of torture or death, then we don't want to make any mistakes there. But maybe we're giving them an unfair benefit of the doubt, because the chance is so slim that maybe we shouldn't really be protecting them. I mean, if there's only a 5% chance, maybe we should roll the dice, you know, and save our spots for people that are much more likely going to suffer the type of harm, assuming that the harm constitutes garden variety persecution or something more. Maybe we should be saving our spots for those people. Matt?
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused as to where the burden of the reasonableness factor lies, because in this case it seems to be on the top of 1003.
Hold on.
Yeah.
I haven't memorized it yet, but I'm going to memorize this textbook over the summer. Okay, go ahead.
On top of 1003, the first full paragraph, a reasonable fact finder would have to conclude that the petitioner
all right, well, you're confusing two different concepts, okay? And does anybody want to help us clarify the confusion? Go ahead, Michael.
Okay, she has the burden of proving these human rights violations that she alleges within the record. And the court, again and again, although I think at times she did try to prove it, they belittle her record. They say it's just not fair. So then the court, in adjudicating this, has to decide whether within the record she has proven that this treatment that would occur to her in Iran would amount to persecution based upon the criteria that the court uses.
Yeah, that's very close. A little bit more directly, there's two different things here. This is her burden of proof. And this, what you're reading from, Matthew, is the standard of review, not the burden of proof. It's the standard of review that the court uses. When we studied Ilya Zacharias, we spent a little bit of time on it, and it's basically saying that if the person doesn't satisfy their burden of proof at the agency level, when the court reviews it, they're not going to reverse that determination unless a reasonable fact finder would be compelled to conclude otherwise. That's the standard of review the court's applying. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions about that? Okay. And another point about well-founded fear is persecution is not well-founded. This is by regulations. If it's reasonable to expect the applicants to relocate internally in their home country. So that just means, listen, if you have a safe haven in your home country, you're not going to be deemed to satisfy your well-founded fear. Now, I just want to, we're going to take a break in a minute, but I had a question the other day, and I want to make sure that everybody sort of understands conceptually what, you know, BIA decisions are and what regulations are, because it's critical. These regulations are rules that have the force of law that are passed by, you know, the Attorney General or the Secretary of Homeland Security. Okay, they go through notice and comment, meaning that they publish proposed rules. We saw some proposed rules that never became final, and the public gets to comment on whether they think it's a good idea or a bad idea. And at the end of the day, they make provisions, and then they pass a rule. It's binding, and basically, it's filling in the details of the statutes. You know, if you read the statutes, it's sort of these broad commands. Some of them are more specific than others, but the regulations sort of fill in some of the gaps of the statutes. So, for example,
The statute requires a well-founded fear of persecution, but doesn't say what well-founded fear means. So the regulation defines what well-founded fear means, or at least helps to put some parameters on it. Now, the Board of Immigration Appeals sort of does the same thing in terms of filling out the details, but instead of publishing a rule through this procedure I just described, where they let the public comment on it, these rules are created in the context of an administrative adjudication, meaning, you know, the parties are before an immigration judge and a legal issue comes up, and the immigration judge makes a legal determination on the question, and then the question gets appealed to the BIA, and then the BIA makes a legal conclusion, makes a legal rule. These have essentially the same force. You know, whether it's passed by a rule or passed by the BIA, essentially have the same force, although the ones by rule are probably, you know, in terms of Chevron analyses, might get more deference over, you know, as opposed to an unpublished BIA decision. Okay, if the BIA decision is published, and all the ones we've looked at in class have been published precedential decisions, they are going to, you know, get Chevron deference, assuming that they are, you know, reasonable interpretations of the statute. Okay, so now that Edward's here, we're going to take a break. And, what did he say?
Finding a seat, yeah.
A lot of people out today. Okay, so let's take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to just spend one more minute on this, and then we're going to do some asylum problems.
We don't start at 1 o'clock today.
What did he say?
We don't start at 1 o'clock today.
No. Edward, no, you're hallucinating. You know, like, this whole semester has been a dream.
You look nice.
Yes, I'll send around a sign and see. If they're unpublished, they might get less seconds. And I'll make another note about it.
Yeah.
Basically,
it doesn't have to be this.
Right. There's two types of BIA decisions. There's published ones, which are like, you know, they're precedential when they publish them. When they're unpublished, they're not precedential. And some courts are sort of torn between whether to give those unpublished ones the type of deference they give to a published precedential decision. I mean, I'll say that again. That's not entirely clear. Even courts issue unpublished decisions, and it's the same effect. It's basically unpublished decisions that decide the case that don't have precedential value. And then they don't have precedential value until it's published. But some courts are still giving deference to unpublished BIA decisions.
Monday, this past Monday. I'm going to try to get this class. Wait, did you have a business?
Running out of energy.
Okay.
But then you won't be able to get the practice problems that you're going to need for the, you know, getting ready for the exam. There's going to be an asylum question on the exam, so no surprises there. Okay. I don't want there to be a surprise there because I have to grade these things and I want them to be legible. You know. I'm going to be able to get through these. Yes. Yeah. Want to say no? So the test, I think I've said this, but the test is definitely going to have at least one essay, probably one or two short essays, one long essay, one or two short essays, and a few multiple choice. I'm going to do it this weekend, so I have to figure out what I think you'll have time to get down on paper. Is everybody using computers, or some people? Everybody? No? Some? Who's not using a computer? Okay. No, okay. Right wheeler.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. Let me ask the question. You have a question, Paul?
Would you be able to take the full 3 hours?
What did it say?
Will it take the full 3 hours?
Yes. Is it 3 or 3.5? I think it's 3.5. No, it's 3. I'll have to check with the registrar's office. Okay. All right. I'll check with the registrar's office. It's going to take the full 3.5.
That's
going to take
3.5.
What do you say?
I'll take 3.5.
Yeah. Okay. So let's do some of these practice problems. They are on. Oh no! Before we do that, I'm sorry. I have to have one more slide. I wanted to find would be threatened from withholding of removal, and this goes back to Jen's point earlier. This would be threatened requires a clear probability of persecution, and the Supreme Court has said that essentially means more likely than not a preponderance of the evidence. And it's a more demanding standard for asylum. Now, that's a bit odd. You know, at the beginning we said asylum is generally the better form of relief, and therefore it's generally harder to get asylum than withholding of removal. But this is an exception. Can anybody explain why they think that might be? There's a question in one of the notes in your casebook. One of the arguments the government made when it litigated this before the Supreme Court was that
well-founded fear should also mean more likely than not. Otherwise, you have a situation where the asylum standard, the asylum well-founded fear is lesser than the more demanding standard. Why do you think, what's the sort of the justification that reconciles that, yeah?
I'm going to guess that because asylum is like a requires more to like, to get under it, and withholding removal. So if you have, since you already like have less to meet as requirements.
When you say that asylum is more, what do you mean?
Like, you have to have those five requirements, you have to fit like the refugee.
But you also have to fit the refugee definition for withholding.
True, but I mean, I think it's a lesser.
So you're saying it's to compensate for some of the other burdens.
Yeah.
Okay, there's actually another reason that the court looked to. Anybody think of it? It's this. It's something that you, Anna, do you want to give it a shot? That would seem to, you know, argue sort of the opposite direction a little bit. You know, if there's all the same reason why it's generally harder to get asylum because of all those benefits. The reason actually is important. I'm not sure I agree with the analysis of the court, but I want to, it's a good way to remind you of one of the big differences between asylum and withholding, is asylum is discretionary. Okay, so what the court said was that even though the standard is less, is smaller, remember, at the end of the day, it's discretionary, and so that sort of compensates and makes it more difficult than withholding, which is mandatory. So if you prove that you're a refugee for asylum purposes, you still have to prove that you're entitled to it as a matter of discretion, whereas for withholding, you're granted withholding automatically if you meet the definition of a refugee. Now, I'll say this. We're not going to spend a lot of time on discretion. I'll give you two sort of general points to keep in mind. First of all, if you demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution, or you're generally not going to be denied asylum. Okay, so you start with the presumption that if you have a well-founded fear of persecution, that it should not be denied as a matter of discretion. Okay, because you're saying, essentially you're saying, well, as a matter of discretion, I'm not going to give you asylum, even though I think you're going to be persecuted, and that's kind of a hard thing to do. But the presumption can be overcome if, for example, you know, you engaged in fraud when you came to this country. You showed them false documents, or you committed certain types of crimes that wouldn't necessarily bar you from asylum, but still nevertheless may be considered as a discretionary factor against you. All right. Now let's do this problem. Now I asked you to work on these in advance of class because I want to be able to get through as many of these as we can. I will give you a few minutes just to sort of regroup your thoughts and to talk with your neighbor to compare what you've come up with, but I'm only going to give you a couple minutes. Yeah, Patrick?
So I have a question pre-class.
Okay.
About like asylum and you know, engaging in fraud and those sorts of things. So is there some sort of like exception for if, like, you had like fraudulent documentation or whatever, but it was under duress, right? Like,
right.
Someone like had a gun to your head and said, "Look, you get in this country with me through, you know, fraudulent documents, or I will blow your brains out."
Well, that's not. That's possible that, you know, conceivably could happen. And, of course, if that was the situation, first of all, you might be using fraudulent documents that you don't know are fraudulent because somebody, you know, somebody gave them to you and you would reason to think that they were legitimate for some reason, okay? Which is kind of rare, but conceivably could happen if somebody else got you your passport or something. You thought they went and got a legitimate one, but they just paid somebody on the black market and got one. You didn't know. Your example would be another one, sort of, it's out of your control. But one of the issues that does come up is the difference between somebody who leaves the country with false documents
and they show up at our borders and give themselves in and say, I have these false documents, but I'm claiming asylum. I'm not trying to rely on them to get into the country. Versus somebody who uses, flees the country and relies on the documents. They come here and they say, hey, right there, let me try here. And they try to get in the country so they're admitted as a visitor, for example. And then it's discovered that this is a fraudulent document. And in those types of cases, the BIA has denied asylum under certain circumstances. Any other questions about that? Okay. Good question, though. Let's take a look at this one. So fanatical army officers stage a successful coup overthrowing a democratically elected government. The new leaders, eager to purge the country of Western influences, have begun a ruthless relocation campaign in which professionals are forcibly removed from the cities to rural areas to perform agricultural labor at subsistence wages. Lawyers have been particularly hit hard since the new government sees them as the bulwark of the old capitalist establishment and is also a symbol of the rule of law. Your client, a lawyer, escaped to the U.S. where she applied for admission. She tells you that if she is sent back, she will be forcibly relocated and required to do agricultural work even though she's 55. She's unaccustomed to that work and is suffering from a heart condition that could be life-threatening if she overexerts herself. She also tells you, consistent with human rights reports, that those who resist relocation are taken away and never heard from again. So I'll give you a few minutes to talk to your neighbor about it, but just a couple. And one thing to think about when you approach these problems, Matter of Acosta sort of provided a framework for these things, which is certainly something you might consider working off of when you address these, you know, whether you're addressing them in a brief to the immigration court, but it's also something you might consider using on the exam. You don't have to use that framework, but obviously the more that you can keep things organized, whether you use that framework or some other, the better off you're probably going to be. Edward?
I'm just excited to hear that some place was still paying subsistence.
That's right. That is a good thing. It wouldn't even have to do that necessarily, but it makes the question more difficult.
Yeah, maybe.
You gotta be a lawyer first, though. Let's go over this together. And a lot of what we're going to do when we do these problems is going to be issue spotting, okay? Because you know, the answers aren't always going to be clear. Don't be frustrated by that, because the answers often are not always clear. But the important thing for you, and obviously the important thing for you on an exam, will be at least to see what the issues are, and then just to do your best with the facts given. As to whether or not you think it comes out one way or the other. And of course, you're going to be graded much more on your analysis and your legal framework than you are on any conclusion that you reach. Assuming that your conclusion is consistent with your analysis and that your analysis is accurate. So where would you start with a problem like this? What's the first question you might ask yourself? Patrick?
Is she a member of the group?
Okay. Okay, is she a member of a group? That's one place you can start. Where else might you start? Yeah? Right, you could start, right, you can start with the refugee definition and break it down. And how would you break it down? Patrick's already said, you know, is she a member of a social group?
If she's being persecuted on account of her membership in that group,
Okay. So I think a good place to start, although you don't have to, but a good place to start is whether or not there's whether or not what she's claiming is persecution at all. You don't have to start there because, if it's not a social group, then you never have to reach the question of persecution. But I'll tell you, for exam purposes, you should go through each of the elements. Don't just stop because you might be wrong. Then you're not going to get the points for some of the other issues that might be raised by some of the other points. So the sub-issues here of whether it's persecution? How do you determine whether or not, and we looked at this when we did Matter of Costa, what are some of the sub-issues of whether something constitutes persecution? Jen? Okay, so right, not the where part, but certainly, the who. Okay, we can start there. Okay, so the who has to be government or a group of government is what?
Unable
or unwilling to control here. So that is the government, right? So that's okay. And what about the what part of persecution? Okay, so one of the issues is whether or not it's individualized. But the question is not that it targets professionals, but whether it would target her. Right? That's what the individualized requirement means. And so, does she satisfy the individualized requirement here? Is there any? What do you guys think? This actually requires a two-step approach, Michael.
Well, I think that I was reading through some of the readings that we didn't cover in class yet, and one of them was about experiences and how that could qualify her for falling within.
But that's a social group issue.
Yeah.
Okay, but we're not there yet. We're talking about, let's stay structured here. We'll turn to that, though, when we get there. Okay, Patrick?
So the Justice Department regulations say that show that it's individualized harm, you must show that there is a pattern or practice of persecution towards a group, and that the applicant is a member of a group. So we see that there's a pattern or practice of persecution against assuming that making her go work and act for work is persecution, there's a pattern of them doing that because they see lawyers as representative of the old regime, and she is a lawyer.
Okay, that's right. That's the right analysis. But there's a little bit, I want to just tweak a little bit of how you approached it, what the regulation actually says. What the regulation says is you generally have to prove that you're singled out. And here, and this is what you'd want to say. They said you want to take it one step at a time. And here, there's no evidence necessarily that she's going to be singled out per se, because nobody came and knocked on her door. That's what singled out means. Nobody threatened her in particular. And then the regulations come in to create an exception to that rule. So you don't have to prove that somebody knocked on your door if there is a systematic practice of persecution and against a group and you're a member of that group. So I think here she qualifies provided that what's happening against her is persecution, which is a separate sub-issue. So what do you think? Is this persecution? You think it's persecution, Rosa?
Well, you're targeting attorneys, right? So that, I think, is like a...
Yeah, let's stay away from groups for now. It is the harm. Again, this is, you don't have to do it this way in an exam. I'm trying to sort of help you categorize the subjects so that you don't miss any steps along the way. What is the harm she's complaining about, and is it persecution? Yeah.
Like they're moving the attorneys from cities to rural areas and forcing them to do labor.
Okay.
Like they're not used to it. They're not qualified. I'm not sure whether that's persecution, but she said that she's 55 and that she would be at risk of dying.
Mm-hmm.
So for her,
maybe it is.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good way to look at it. Generally, economic harm alone is not going to be persecution, so I think it's probably not enough.
In other words, if you, let's say she was allowed to work as a lawyer, I'm changing the facts here, but was only allowed to make half as much money. Okay, so that's like a pure economic harm situation, and that's probably not persecution. Here it's a little bit worse, because she's being required to give up her chosen field. And you might want to contrast here, you know, giving up being a taxi driver from giving up being a lawyer, which presumably she went to, you know, graduate school for and got trained for. And so that looks a little bit worse, although even that might not rise to the level of persecution. But when you throw in the fact that she may, you know, keel over dead, maybe then it's looking a little bit more like persecution. So, you know, on an exam, you would simply, you just basically make the arguments, you know, say, this may not be a law enough, or maybe it's a little bit worse because of her situation, but the fact that she may keel over dead may bring it to the level of persecution, and you could even conclude it's still not entirely clear, but then assume for the rest of, for the rest of your exam that it is persecution just to get through all the other elements. Edward?
Do you think that relocation would be
I don't really understand the question. Are you talking about the harm of being relocated, or the fact that her refusal to relocate might be a political opinion?
Well, I thought we could. Political opinion stuff.
Okay.
And when a ruling government rounds up professionals, and especially lawyers, that's generally to prevent political opposition. So it's a pretty strong sense of that whole refusal.
Right. So we've jumped ahead now to a different part of the refugee definition, which is, so I just want to make, fine, I just want to make sure that conceptually we know what we're doing. We've jumped ahead to whether or not she is claiming persecution on account of one of the five protected grounds, and the protected ground you're identifying is political opinion. And then the sub-issue you're identifying is whether or not imputed political opinion might be an appropriate analysis here. And all that's right. And that's exactly, you know, part of the analysis you would take if this was an exam question. Patrick, do you have a question?
No. Comment. Back to whether or not it's persecution. Even if, you know, she's, like, doing her work and consider persecution, doesn't it still depend on whether or not she would resist? Right, under the last case that we talked about,
right.
if she could either be the group of lawyers, right, or the group of lawyers who disagrees with doing what they have to do, but would do it anyway,
right.
Or the group of lawyers who disagrees so much that she would resist and then end up being taken away and never heard from again.
Right.
And then if she follows it with that third group, then she could, you know, claim that that is persecution because she
right.
would be so funded. So fundamental to her identity that she would refuse.
Right. That's right, and that's certainly could be part of the analysis. The only difference in this case is that even if she goes ahead with it, it might be persecution or fear of persecution because of the risk that she's going to keel over and have a heart attack.
I'm saying I follow that.
Right.
I'm saying even if the court doesn't buy that, even if
all right. So if that's not persecution,
if the court says that. Her killing over from the risk of her killing over from a heart attack is enough to constitute persecution.
Right.
Right. It's only 2% chance, whatever.
Right.
Right.
Oh, but she can't.
Yes, she can still claim persecution if she is the third group of people.
Right. If she says that I would not do this because of the fact that I might have a heart attack, and because I'm not going to do this, I might disappear, then yes, absolutely. It could be, if she made that claim, then yes, she could qualify. Rosa?
Just wondering, the three categories from the Schoenberg case, the Schoenberg case, do we apply that in the analysis, like in the same way the court did, or was that more to, like, fast similar cases?
What you could say is which three, not the three different social groups, but the three-part test, it's got to be a particular social group. You have to be a member of that group. Right, and you have to be persecuted on account of that group. But I think I have no problem with any of those tests. I mean, because those are
make sense. I mean, you can't just say, hey, there's a political group over there. I'm not part of it. Obviously, you have to be part of it if you're going to claim it. And the other one, you have to be persecuted on account of it. Well, that's part of the language. So the problem with Faten or Faten was how the court applied those to the circumstances. And so you would have to, you know, if there was an analogous situation, you'd have to grapple with whether or not you might apply them differently, or which court you were in, or the, you know, one court did this, but another court might do that. Now, okay, so when we talked about political opinion here, all right, so you, let's assume that we've established persecution, okay, and the who, the what, and so on. The other issue here might be, what is this, prosecution or persecution? Right, so that's another issue. And then you'd have to think to yourself, well, what is she really being prosecuted for? It's not like having a trial or anything. She's just being like, she probably put on the back of a truck and brought out to the countryside. That's certainly an issue here. I mean, is the government, does the gov- can the government legitimately prosecute her for what it believes to be, you know, her connection to the old establishment? Probably not, but so certainly the issue is certainly raised by these facts. And then after that, you get to the persecution analysis. Then you want to say, is it on account of one of the five protected social groups? You know, don't just rush to say, is it on account of political opinion or a social group? Let me know on the exam that you know that there's five of them and that these are two possible ones that might apply here. Political opinion, because you know, maybe it's a political opinion that she doesn't want to relocate, or maybe it's imputed on her, or maybe she's part of the social group as someone who, you know, as a lawyer. I mean, you have to decide whether or not that's a particular enough social group. I think the answer probably would be yes under these facts. Okay. Any other questions about those? So, you know, keep it. You know, the whole area of the asylum laws is very, there's a lot to remember, a lot to keep in mind, and there's a lot of lines that aren't clearly drawn, but your analysis, your framework can be mechanical. You know, and I recommend that you come up with some system, and I'm not going to tell you which one to do, but I do recommend you come up with some system for tackling these types of problems, which will help you not miss any issues, and which will keep your analysis organized. Yes.
What social group does she fall into? Like, what would be the social group?
So the social group, oh, that's a good question. What do you think? Or does, if you really don't have an idea, maybe I'll let someone else answer it.
I don't think she
fall. Okay, why not?
Because based on the social group definition of the immutable and a common characteristic.
Okay.
I mean, being a professional, you don't have to always be a professional.
Okay, so I mean that's the issue, and I'm glad actually you brought that up, because probably I went over it a little too quickly. Kim's actually right. Maybe there is an issue here. There is an issue here about whether or not she actually does qualify as a social group, and you start, well, is there an immutable characteristic here? As part of the group that she's claiming, and the answer is, well, there's no innate characteristic here. What she's claiming is her profession as being a lawyer. And so then the question is, well, maybe she qualifies based on her past experiences. Now, the thing to keep in mind for past experiences is not any past experience is going to qualify, all right, only certain ones. And so the question is this type of past experience, do you think the agency might recognize as an immutable one? You know, being a taxi driver in Acosta wasn't. But maybe there's something different about being a lawyer that makes her past experience more like being an ex-military leader or something. Yeah.
What about arguing that, you know, they've got choosing your work sets fundamental liberty to, like, or individual liberty, and that by being denied, like, choosing her profession or being forced to think like that, you're violating her.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
Like the second size for immutable is a characteristic so fundamental to individual liberty or
right.
Conscience. So, like, I would argue maybe that choosing your profession is a fundamental individual liberty.
Right. I think that, and I think that you make the same argument that you might for past experiences, and the question is whether or not being a lawyer is something so fundamental that you shouldn't have to give up, and you want to contrast maybe being a taxi driver, which is something that, as a society, we might expect someone to give up to avoid being persecuted, but maybe someone who's a lawyer, because of what they stand for, you know, the rule of law, they've got a degree, and so on and so forth, is something different, and maybe it's more like being a landowner, or more like being rich, where, you know, the BIA said we wouldn't expect a divestiture, you know, and so maybe this is sort of a similar situation. Question, Brandon?
Yeah, we didn't really discuss the last sentence about how that they've taken away forever and ever.
Uh-huh.
That alone, say this is not persecution, but say the punishment is in proportion to the crime, I'll say. Would that alone get her to get asylum based on that, just that persecution?
Well, yeah, and this goes back to Patrick's point. It depends on what she's going to do. If she says that she's going to go ahead and work, then she's not going to be subject to this, and so she can't really rely on it, except maybe to say that, you know, they're taking this stuff seriously. And so, you know, this is evidence of how seriously they're taking it, so they're not going to let me off the hook just because I'm old. I mean, you might want to play with it maybe that way, Patrick.
I haven't taken ethics, but...
And I haven't taken it in 10 years, so go easy on it. All right.
But, you know, as an attorney advising the client, right, can you say, you know, not, you know, you should talk to the law before you're going to refuse, right? But, you know, here is what the law is. If you testify that you're going to refuse to, that you're going to resist, then you're more likely to have a good asylum claim than if you tell the court that you're going to go ahead and work.
Right. I mean, I think that there's a very gray area there. I mean, there's sort of the similar point I made in the Batson case. You clearly can't tell your client to lie. I think that's an easy one. How far you could go in hinting at it by advising you, and it's clear that you have to advise your client on the law, right? So the gray area is tough, and you have to ask Monroe Friedman what he thinks. Yes.
Again.
So there's ways to do it, and the question are those ways going to fall on which line of the ethical, you know, or non-ethical is that going to fall? And I'm sure there's some degree of actions you could take that would be completely ethical, and there's some that would clearly not be. And then, you know, where that line is drawn is hard to say, because you do have to zealously, you have to zealously represent your client. So, but how zealous can you be? Any other questions about this? Okay. Let's do problem number 2. It's a long one. Can't even read it, huh?
This isn't the textbook, so just you can get it to the textbook.
The government of a foreign country is a democracy, has lately been denouncing homosexuals, accusing them of immorality and of spreading AIDS. Spurred on by that rhetoric, private citizens have frequently attacked and looted businesses owned by homosexuals and have occasionally assaulted those who seem, quote-unquote, seemed gay. Your client tells you that he lived and worked in an area of the capital that is widely known to be a gay neighborhood. He ran a bookstore that specialized in gay and lesbian books. 2 doors down from his store, a coffee shop with gay clientele had been firebombed and several patrons killed. The next day, there appeared on the door of your client's bookstore a note warning him to expect the same. He called the police. The officer with whom he spoke told him there was nothing the police could do. The officer added that sodomy was a criminal offense punishable up to 10 years in prison, that the government was vigorously enforcing the law, and that your client had better think about that. Think about that. As a matter of principle, your client will not disclose his sexual orientation. So, I want to make sure we take 2 minutes just to ponder this one, and that I do want to finish this one today. Thank you.
Right,
let's do it. Okay, so what are the possible bases for persecution, for a persecution claim here, or an asylum claim here? Let's right. Obviously, we're going to have a social group issue here, but let's stick with. Let's stick with persecution first, okay? Rosa?
The police do persecution, I mean, the second issue is that, because you're not sure. I mean, the government is just denouncing homosexuals, but the citizens are the ones carrying out, like, the attacks.
Okay, so the first question is, if we're focusing on the attacks by, the so-called non-state actors, right? The question is that enough? And how would you respond to that?
I think that it might be a group that the government is not willing to control.
Okay, and what facts would you rely on to support that?
Because they're publicly denouncing homosexuals and creating circumstances where persecution is high, like risk of persecution is higher. When he pulled the police, like, they weren't willing to help them. So it's one thing to say that.
Well, you could stop there, because I think that covers it. I think that covers it. So that's exactly what you would argue. You would look to sort of the general country conditions and the fact that, you know, the government itself is sort of creating an environment where it's this treatment of homosexuals is acceptable. Plus, in particular, you went to the police, and the police didn't look like they were willing to help. So the who of persecution is met. What about the what of persecution? Now, it's just a fear of it, but what's the fear? What's the fear that he's claiming? What actually, you know, what's he talking about here? Let's see if someone else wants to chime in. Kim, can you get your hand up?
Yeah, he fears being attacked, like what he did to the person sort of next door to him.
Okay, so he fears being blown up.
Right.
So that qualifies, right? you talk about the spectrum of harms. He's fearing being blown off. That qualifies. And what are some other issues as to persecution?
It said that they assaulted people who seem gay also, so that how these fears being assaulted.
Okay. Okay, so in addition to being blown up, he's also facing possible assault. Are there any other issues under the heading of persecution we need to think about? Yes.
The individualized harm.
Good. Okay. So, whether the individualized harm requirement is met here, the answer is yes, because he got a note on his door. I think that satisfies it. Now, what about? So, I think the persecution prong doesn't appear to really be a problem here. Okay. So what's the next step?
Well,
Okay. Well, let's make it even more. Let's go one step back. Whether or not the persecution will be on account of a protected ground, right? And then let's identify which protected grounds. And so you're saying social group. Okay, so that's not a problem, right? Because we said that homosexuals are a protected social group. All right? Yes?
The question is, he's not saying whether he's homosexual or not.
So. Right. That's the wrinkle. Right. So how do you handle that situation? What she said, if you didn't hear in the back, that he's not going to say whether he's a homosexual or not. And so, go ahead.
I would say that they're imputing a social group on him being a gay person.
Okay. So. And have we looked at any cases of imputing social group? What? You don't remember? Yeah, Michael?
There was some stuff that we had in the whole courses, like enough cases. There was the Lazo Mahano case, which was actually even closer to getting a good result for this gentleman here, in which we could even use falsely or sentencing in political opinion there. But yeah, it was
but here's the
1969 to 1997.
And here's the rub, though. All the cases we looked at talked about imputed political opinion, and this is imputed social group. And so, don't make that logical jump without explaining that you're making it. You know, you want to argue to a court or argue on an exam that, you know, although imputed political opinion has been recognized, it's not clear whether it would apply in the social group context. And that would be probably enough. Does anybody have a reason to think that there shouldn't be imputed social group, but there should be imputed political opinion? Yeah?
It's for the same theory of why they have imputed political opinion. That, you know, it shouldn't matter whether the government's right or not in its persecution. The problem is that it's persecuted.
Right. So there you have it. What about, there's another potential argument here, another potential asylum claim based on a different set of facts from this fact pattern. What is it? Rosa.
Like the.
Okay, that's okay.
You reword the one basis that we already found.
So the first basis is persecution by non-state actors that the government is unable or are unwilling to control on account of his social group, either imputed or otherwise. That's what we just talked about. Now there's another. Kim. Okay, so you might make an argument for political opinion. What would the argument be? Right. So yeah, I think that's a good argument. So the argument is that his political opinion is against what the government is proposing here. And of course you have to prove it, so what can you do? Well, he owns a bookstore, not just any store, a bookstore which sells, I think it's part of the fact pattern, but presumably if it's not selling, okay, so specializing in gay and lesbian books. Okay, there you have it. So that's the argument. So that's sort of a subcategory of the non-state actor problem of this. What's the other half? There's another claim here that this person can make. Pretend you're his lawyer. What are you gonna argue? What can you argue? Kira? Okay, so we have this situation, right? It's not so much the here prosecution, though that's the hook. We talked about the non-state actors, but he's got a claim that he's going to be persecuted by the government itself. And the hook is the fact that they have this criminal offense on the books, and
then the question becomes, well, a few questions. What are some of the questions implicated in this, on that claim? Want to take a shot at it, Kira? Okay, are they vigorously, and what would that go to, whether they're vigorously enforcing the law? As if you, if you're linking that to
makes
the
refugee,
okay, it makes it more likely. Okay, good. What are some of the other issues embedded in there? Yeah?
Like false conviction, right? We don't know whether or not he actually is engaging in sodomy, and yet if they're vigorously enforcing the law, and they're, like, we don't know, right? But if they're convicting people based on circumstantial evidence, right? You go out of a gay and lesbian bookstore and you live in the gay neighborhood, therefore you must be gay.
Right.
Sort of thing.
And what might the argument against that be? That, you know, to detract from the fact that this is really a well-founded fear. Patrick?
We have to trust that unless we have reason to believe that other countries' judicial systems are flawed, we have to trust the judicial system.
Okay, that's sort of one that talks more about the judicial system, but what else? What else about, you know, this threat here? What might you argue? David? I mean, Brian? Sorry.
He has to turn a bias to him because he doesn't identify, he won't identify whether he is or isn't.
Okay. So. Right, but if he engages in an act, would it matter necessarily whether he was gay or not? I mean, if he engages, the law applies to sodomy, it doesn't specify, at least not in the fact pattern, that it applies only to homosexuals. So one of the issues here, this is like a facially neutral law, so that's one of the sub-issues. Okay, and whether or not it's whether it's prosecution or persecution, and the issue there will be whether it's being whether even though the law is facially neutral, it's being used to target homosexuals. We don't know this from the facts, but it's certainly something within the realm of what you would want to argue or suggest is at least an issue you want more information from this fact pattern. The other thing you might point out is that, you know, what kind of threat was this, really? I mean, was this a real threat? Or was this sort of like, get out of my office kind of threat? Who knows? You know, again, the facts obviously don't spell it out, but these are the issues that would come up in a hearing. And so, like, I don't want you going off on hypothetical tangents, but things of that nature are certainly relevant to what are the additional types of information you would need, or the issue here is, okay, there's a threat, but is this a real threat or is this an empty threat? If it's an empty threat, it goes to whether it's a well-founded fear. If it's a real threat, then it goes that it's more likely to be a well-founded fear. And we don't know based on the circumstances, but you might be able to argue both ways. Any questions about that? All right, that's it. Just don't pack up yet, because I do have you for one more minute. So on Monday, which is probably, like I said, I'll let you know, I'll send you an email, or I'll probably just end up telling you Monday, it's very likely that's going to be our last class. We have a two-hour class, we're going to finish going over these asylum problems, we're going to have a review session, and I have exactly zero questions from you for the review. So it's up to you guys. The review session is going to be long or it's going to be short. So, and I understand a lot of you, and I don't criticize you for this. It's just the nature of it. A lot of you aren't putting off your studying until you have time, and that means probably after classes are over. But so for those of you who have begun putting your outlines together or have questions, now's the time to ask them if you want to have this covered in a review session. So email them to me over the weekend, and if you're inclined to, and we'll talk about them. Yeah.
About your email and the status and the order.
Right.
So like you don't need to know
like
the exact formula.
Right. I'm not going to ask you to do any math. Okay. Yeah. I mean, so you don't have to. I'm not going to ask you to figure out any quotas, but you have to understand generally, you know, how they work and why we have them and. Thank you.